CliffCentral.com.
All right. Very nice. I hope your day's off to a good start. CliffCentral.com. We're keeping you company this morning. You know, I'm the first one to admit when we get it wrong. And last week, Thursday, on the 7th of May, we said that Dis-Chem had been found guilty of excessive pricing, and they haven't. They have been referred to the Competition Commission, and it's gone to the Competition Tribunal for prosecution. And that's Dis-Chem for excessive pricing due to the state of national disaster as declared by President Cyril Ramaphosa. And while they've been charged with allegations of excessive price fixing, they're in the process of presenting their case before the tribunal. It has not been found guilty. Dis-Chem has not been found guilty. So I'm going to reiterate that we were incorrect. And we mentioned the excessive pricing on hygiene products, which is in fact on masks. And there are a range of items which fall under hygienic goods. So we were wrong to say that they were already guilty. I don't know that we said that. I know that there was a case going on, but for what it's worth, we were incorrect. So we were alerted to this and would like to retract those comments. And hopefully we get to talk to Dis-Chem once all of this is wrapped up and we get to find out what the actual state of play is there. Because obviously there are people, I mean, there's Dis-Chem up the road from me and people are lining up around the block to go there for their essential goods and for their pharmaceuticals and all the rest of it. So I want to find out what the state of play is there anyway. And hopefully Dis-Chem come to the party at some point so we can talk to them after the controversy has subsided and we'll see whether or not, you know, they've got a story to tell. I'm sure there'll be loads of interesting information that we can share after lockdown has ended about what people have been buying, where they've been buying it, what their priorities have been. Could be some interesting insights into the market and into the business of Dis-Chem. So I'm looking forward to speaking to them at some point in the very near future. So we're going to talk to Rorisang Chabalala just now. He's an old CliffCentral.com family member, and we're going to speak to him about some of the latest research into herd immunity and whether or not that is something worth considering. He's a strategist currently. He's taken a look at herd immunity, and we wanted to hear his take on it this morning, just so that we can keep informing ourselves with all the varying opinions and points of view and some of the data around what is going on with COVID-19. Best that we keep ourselves open to new information rather than right. Just confirmation bias.
So do you want to take a look at some new stories before we go to Rorisang?
Do you know what, Sia? I really want that. What have you got for us?
Thank you for considering that. Yeah. Well thought decision. Yes, well thought out yes, there. Yes. I'm sure by now we've all seen that video that was being shared all over the place yesterday afternoon of a father trying to prevent two traffic officers from removing his child from this gated complex. Did you see that?
Is that like a gated complex?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a standalone house. My God. So they came into the complex and then to his house.
Yeah.
So what actually happened? Because you see immediately outrage and upset and people are emotional on social media. But what's the real story?
Here we go. So the truth and the context behind the video that surfaced on social media yesterday is that two traffic officers from KwaDukuza, this is happening here in KZN, walked into the complex in Salt Rock on the north coast. One of them takes the child is crying, manic in the video, who was dressed in a swimming costume by his hand, and he walks off, and that officer is later joined by his colleagues, but that's also when the child's father, who is wearing swimming gear, runs after the official, grabs the child. He starts screaming things like, get your hands off this child. Somebody called the police. The child is later then released, and the officers still keep their hands on the man. Now, KwaDukuza has now spoken out about this, saying that they are aware of this video and they're aware of the incident that has occurred. And currently, they have just said that they are investigating all of this video and the surroundings around it.
Who is taking the video?
That hasn't been clear in the statement, but this is Sipho Mkhize, who is the municipal spokesperson for Kwadukuza, who says that the preliminary information gathered indicated that the parents were at the beach with the children. And so beaches are closed, as you can see by the child's attire. They were there, and they were there in the wrong and then went home. He later goes on to explain, I don't want to begin to condone how the matter was handled, given the high emotion around why the child was being held. The parents were in the wrong in this instance, but how the operation was conducted, given the public expression, is something we have to deal with internally with those affected. So they do admit that they are still looking for information, which includes locating a full-length video of the incident, and that all those need to come together so that they can see what has happened.
Fascism.
Well, fascists. So obviously, Pumi, you know that we've got to separate the optics of this out from the facts. The facts are probably that something was going on that made these police officers investigate the situation. There might have been something that is against lockdown regulations, whatever. But we leave the facts
alone. So
what
alone. I read,
the optics. Hold on. The optics. Here's the problem. The optics are cops, traffic cops, Nohal. Taking someone's child away from them, there's no way that the cops come out of this looking good.
So,
you heard the neighbors report
the
to them?
Okay, so yeah. Yeah, there was a cordon involved. Right. Phoned the police to say, they're on the beach, which, you know, as we're all doing, they'll be policey. Mm-hmm. This is, for me, more than just optics, Darren, is that as this policeman, what I saw on the video is the policeman is holding the child by the hand.
All right.
And walking away with the child. And then you see this man run towards them and pick up the child and try and grab the child away from the policeman, who's still holding the child by the hand. And he reacts by holding onto the child. So you've got these two grown people dragging this, and that child looks like he's 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, man.
Two people pulling on either side. And whatever it is it just is an awful thing to look at. And none of those individuals, not the fire, not the police, should have been in a position where they're tearing at this child. So that's just... Also, well, I think it's the neighbor's child.
That's horrible. But first of all, what is wrong with this Karen who reported people for being on the beach? I mean, if she's such a good citizen, why doesn't she go down to the beach herself and say, hey, guys, you know you're not allowed here. I'm sorry. I'm tempted to call the police because that's the kind of loser I am. But please, if you don't mind, let's all abide by lockdown regulations because I'm not allowed on the beach, so neither are you. Because that's what it boils down to. Of course, that's never going to happen. But then we end up in a situation where now – there's got to be a villain and there's got to be a good guy, right?
Fascism. That's what we're watching. Do you know the Linton? Do you know who Linton Kwesi Johnson is?
Yeah.
LKJ. He's got a song.
Sorry.
Yes?
Say, Sia?
No, pardon. I interrupted you there.
No, but I mean, he's got that song that says fascists. Fascism's on the attack here. That's, I think, the by and large, what we're seeing across the country is we're seeing incredibly ill-trained, ill-equipped law enforcement officers of every sort just completely losing their minds, even in the face of the most benign experiences. They're just responding and reacting with the most ludicrous and excessive force. And it just... That's what it is. It's just fascism.
Yeah, there's
no other
no way that the cops come out of this looking like good guys, because even if that person who is pulling at the child, whether it's the parent or the neighbor, I don't know, neighbor of the child's parent or whatever the case may be, there's no way the cops come out of this looking good. And you saw how it spread like wildfire on social media, and that's because people love being outraged and people love getting emotional about stuff. So whoever is right or wrong disappears to the back of the story, and suddenly it's about cops trying to take a kid away from its parents. That's what it looks like, and that's all people are going to remember.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think
announced that the municipality came to directing or commenting on those type of claims. They just said, we don't want to seem as if we are policing human beings. We just want everybody to stay at home and adhere to regulations.
Suka. And people's response to the police is going to increasingly be "I suka." And you know what's going to happen, though, is that the police will become more violent and more brutal as people start to rebel, until the point where people are in open rebellion against the police. And it's not going to take long to get there. And it takes one or two incidents where they seem to be taking a child, where even if it looks like that, it may not be the case. We don't know enough yet. But if it looks like they've taken a child away from its parents, yes, sis, you will see South Africans of all races and all classes and all backgrounds and all resources suddenly stand up and say, you go fuck yourself. Because no parent will tolerate their kid being pulled away from them by a cop. No parent. And you'll see some very suitable young women and men suddenly start to become violent with police and take their chances. And I just hope it doesn't result in an event where someone gets killed, as we had at the beginning of lockdown, where there was that one guy who was killed by the police. Do you remember that story?
In Alexander.
Yeah.
In Alexander.
And it's gone away now. And people have kind of just forgotten about it. But let me tell you something. That happens again. And if it happens enough times, then Cyril's got a big problem on his hands.
Cyril has already got a big problem on his hands. So shame, guys. Shame, guys. I don't want to talk about Cyril.
Hey,
don't want to be that person.
Because Pumi yesterday, Cyril came up and I said, oh, well, wait, we'll pose this to Pumi. And then I thought, no, it's not fair, because otherwise you seem to be constantly criticizing.
I'm his biggest fan.
Yeah, sure.
A more genuine look on your face. A more believable.
I am
a fan. I want the best for the man.
No, yeah.
I want the best for the man.
You might be holding a gun to him. The side of your head there.
Might I just ask, what is that best that you want for the man? What is the best for him, just out of interest, in your opinion?
In my opinion, you know, I just want him to be the best that he can be. the best that you can be. Like a good friend. I'm a good friend to the man. I'm always just saying, Guy, is this really the best that you can be? Is this it? Because I don't think he's got enough people around him saying, be the best guy. And sometimes being the best means walk away.
This is the height of what they call filibustering.
Aye, man.
Yeah, filibustering. And also a little bit of passive aggressive going
there
on.
Is.
Yeah, all right. Well.
Passive aggressive.
just a little.
Yes,
right.
Neando Tuba.
we have to get to Rorisang Chabalala, which we'll do in a moment. I want to get us some messages quickly before we go to Rory. Fuck the Karens. I'm in a name and shame any Karen that I know, is what one person says on WhatsApp here. That's Hugo. Yeah, but the problem is sometimes you don't know which Karen reported you, you know?
Hey, the irony there. It's Hugo. You sent the message.
Yucho Banapolisi, yeah. Yucho Banapolisi. That's right. I forgot about that. That was a good time. Watch morning.
Yeah. When we were allowed to go outside.
Apparently, they threw the father and nine others into Umhlali's police cells for hours after that story. And now they've started to tell the full story about what happened at the Shaka's Rock complex. So there is plenty more information. A Gestapo state, here we come, says somebody. It is sad that people feel they need to contact the authorities to report something like this. Clearly the neighbor is a bitter, twisted, and angry person. I'm telling you now, our real enemy may not be the people who are trying to enforce these ridiculous lockdown regulations. Our real enemy may be living in the house next door to us. Our real enemy may be... No, really. I've said this from the beginning.
Because what you don't know is you don't know how they report the incident. So what the law enforcement officials arrive there feeling that they're going to come across. So they arrive hyped up because I'm sure that you didn't get a phone call saying, there's somebody on the beach with three kids.
No, they probably said there's someone with guns and they're endangering the community and they've been making a noise.
Endangering the kids.
And they're drunk and they're trading in illegal cigarettes and they're passing COVID on to each other. You can imagine. So
they're licking each other with the COVID.
I'm telling you, you just be very careful with your neighbors. Don't trust them. And even if you think you know them, because they could also be having a bad day and it sounds like you're having more fun than they are. And then they report you. And then we end
up with... if you are having more fun than me, Gareth, right now.
You're gonna report me? That's what's going to happen. All right. Well, let's talk to Rorisang. How are you, sir? It's nice to speak to you. I haven't seen you in a long, long time. Are you well?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you guys?
Good, man. Excellent. Excellent. So, Rory, first of all, congratulations. I believe you got married earlier this year. Pumi says she was at your wedding. So thanks for inviting the rest of us.
Do you know that I did not notice she was at my wedding until like the last minute?
That's not very nice.
Oh,
I know, can't imagine. I'm like, recognize me.
I'm like in the middle of the photo shoot. I'm like, wait a minute. Like, wait, what? Just wait a minute. That's for me.
Now, it's been a long time since we had you on with Frankly Speaking, and in those days, you caused a lot of controversy. I have no doubt that you're still causing controversy.
Ruckus.
But you,
I was a petty. I was prone to petty socialism back then, Gareth.
Yeah, those are the days. Hopefully, you've reformed. But now you're taking a look at herd immunity. So I want to hear from you because you've been looking at this. Analytically, and I'd like to know what you can tell us about this, because you hear a lot of people talking about herd immunity, and maybe it is and maybe it isn't the way to go. We hear people quoting that Sweden is trying to do this. We know that Boris tried it in Britain before everybody started getting sick, and then because of public opinion, did a very quick about turn. So what's the story? What do you got to share with us this morning?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the first thing is that I'm not an expert in herd immunity. I guess I was in the South African context, whenever something comes up, we tend to all jump onto whichever side we feel looks like us,
yeah,
without actually understanding what the issues are. So we've all been speaking about herd immunity. The question is whether, you know, do we understand what herd immunity is? And I was one of those. I really didn't. I mean, apart from just a passing understanding of it, I hadn't actually bothered to understand what it was. So I decided to just do a little bit of digging. And by and large, herd immunity suggests that if enough of us get infected, eventually there are enough of us that, you know, the virus can't really spread anymore because, you know, basically, the herd has been infected, and we're now immune from it. But I think the thing that's worth highlighting there is that it's if enough of us get infected and survive, that's when we can achieve herd immunity. So the academic literature, for instance, suggests that you need to achieve a threshold of between 70% to 95% of, let's call it, infection and survival for you to get to a stage of herd immunity. So the issue is that it's not just about, you know, all of us getting infected. It's how many of us get infected and survive. And I think the difference between coronavirus and, let's say, the flu is that the flu is generally not, it does not grow as exponentially and has not been shown to be as, let's call it, exponentially fatal as what coronavirus has proven itself to be. So for that reason, that's where then the issues come to say, well, are we going to wait for herd immunity? You know, how many people would have to die for us to get to a stage where 70 to 95% of the population has been infected and survives?
Well, surely the answer to that is the same number of people that will die until we find a vaccine. So that number is already set by God or by the disease, and there's nothing we can do about it. The question, though, is it worth pursuing a strategy of herd immunity? And we obviously, Rory, I mean, you can help me with this. We're discovering new facts about this disease every day. And like I said at the start of the show when we were talking about Twitter and fake news and how people have been spreading fake news, in the beginning, Imperial College, a guy called Neil Ferguson at Imperial College, who's been shown widely to have been a completely rubbish source on this disease. He was the one who said in the beginning that the death rates, the fatalities of people infected by COVID could be as much as 4%. And that's been widely debunked now. The actual rate of death by populations in the world, and obviously in South Africa, we haven't tested nearly as many people as they have in other countries. But we're trying to get the testing up because that'll help us figure out what that denominator is rather than just the numerator. But so far, it's seemed to be somewhere around 0.1 to 0.4% at the very far extremes, 0.1 being the lowest and 0.4 being the highest in terms of tested people and people who've actually died from or shown very, very acute symptoms of COVID-19. So we're gathering information, right? We're still not at a point where we can say this is the whole picture because we don't know.
Yeah. And I guess that the difference, and maybe this is where I agree with Pumi there about just feeling sorry for Cyril, is the difference between me and him is that there's no consequence to me being wrong. There is great consequence to him being wrong. And so our confidence in opining is quite different, right? So I'm wrong and nothing happens. He's wrong, and a lot of people die. But I think the other part that we tend to miss is that, you know, Cyril also has, so apart from the economic implications, the health implications, the social implications, he also has to consider the political implications. And I think for me and you looking at him, we might say, well, that's a petty consideration. But let's not forget that not too long ago, the fact that Cyril might not become the president and somebody else might become president was a very big deal for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has to balance out a little bit more variables than what you and I would have to do. And as a result, I guess we then see a more conservative approach. So, you know, I 100% agree with you that we're getting new information all the time. The question is, what's the cost of being wrong as opposed to the fact that, you know, we're here.
Really, and the other thing, though, that Cyril, in my view, that Cyril is acutely aware of, is there is another president in this country still living who history has not absolved, who got a particular thing wrong, about an illness. And it keeps coming back to haunt a man who otherwise had a really good record.
And so on and so forth and stuff like
and
that.
And so on and so forth. Exactly.
Like that. Exactly. Becky. And he's, for all we know, he's still taken to the bottle far too hard.
Exactly.
Those things are a very real reality. If he gets this thing wrong.
Yeah.
It could be disastrous.
But are they actually looking at the science? Because while we sit here and we debate, well, you know, these are the death rates, these are the infection rates, this is the contagious level at which this thing operates, we also know that COVID doesn't, for the most part, kill anyone under the age of 40. The deaths all over the world have shown that people under the age of 40 are virtually, with a very small percentage of error, and in those errors, obviously, it costs lives. But again, let's not be... We're looking at statistics here. Let's not get emotive. The fact is, if you're under 40 years old, chances of you dying of COVID are minimal, if at all. And this is something to be considered. So closing schools, for example, is a stupid strategy unless there are old people at home who are vulnerable and the kids come home and they're then exposed to those old people who could be very much more badly and adversely affected by the disease, right?
Not quite, Gareth. I think the other thing for us to consider, so for instance, in South Korea over the weekend, they have had to go back into instituting lockdown after, you would remember that they were considered a success story.
South Korea,
and they've had to go back because a 25-year-old had been exposed to I don't know how many people at a nightclub over the weekend, and they've basically had to just tighten up again. And I think the important thing for us to realize is that those nightclub conditions are replicated every single day in the trains and the buses and so on, right? So that is a function of our poor infrastructure and transport system. So I think the issue is that the moment that you open the gate and say, well, let the kids go back to school, what you're setting in motion, the issue isn't just what happens in the schooling environment, what's then sets in motion is an entire logistics chain and so on.
But
and the question again is, who wants to take the chance, right? It's not a scientific issue.
Can't we say that Cyril has already got it wrong? Even with his conservative approach, he's already got it wrong, because we know that poverty is the single greatest determinant of people's health, whether good, bad, or ugly. And you can argue that we have poor people and now even poorer people in South Africa who will be vulnerable to any number of diseases, including COVID, as a result of the fact that not only they're living in squalor very often, but also these people have no means of getting the basic health care that they need. And the effects of shutting down the economy are going to be far more devastating for those people, just on the basis that poverty is the biggest determinant for health, than COVID could ever have been as a disease on its own.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in my view, that point is moot, in the sense that, yes, I mean,
moot?
You know, well, it's moot in the sense that what is what is right now, right? There's nothing we can do about the fact right now, right?
But if we're going to talk about a strategy, and you're a strategist, government strategy in this case could have piled up more bodies than if we had just left the economy alone and we had let people figure out their own strategy around this. I mean, we know that the townships aren't under lockdown at all. And we know that people are lining up for food parcels because they're starving. You know, this is potentially a recipe for disaster, regardless of what you and I and Pumi are doing in the suburbs, where we are staying locked down and, you know, we're able to do our work from a distance like we are this morning. That has no real implications for ordinary people in this country.
You know, one of the things, can I also just throw this in, Rory, while you contemplate what Gareth is saying? One of the things that, just looking at the strategy and looking at how South Africa has responded to COVID, is I'm intrigued at the fact that one of the big factors that for us here in the South, which is different from the North and China, is those guys were coming when they got the disease and when it was at its height. They were in winter, coming out of winter. We are at the beginning of winter going into, and that also has a factor in terms of people's immunity. Already we know this, right? That in winter you are more susceptible to flu and all sorts of other things. Yeah. And we don't have any of that data. So those guys, even as they're opening up in summertime. For them, in spring and summertime, they're opening up. So those.
But what about the fact that we have a lot more robust a vaccination system in South Africa, in many respects, because we are vaccinated against a whole lot of diseases where other countries are not necessarily. And I'm talking about supposedly first world countries. Plus, we have a very much younger population. You know, the average age here is much lower, and age has been shown to be one of the major contributing factors.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that we need to grapple with, Gareth, is I remember this thing, it's not a purely health thing, nor a social thing, or an economic thing. Part of why a guy like Cyril slows down a very complex system is not simply to slow the rate of infection. It's to just like, you know, can we slow things down so we can wrap our heads around it? And by that is,
for them to wrap their heads around anything is going to take way longer than lockdown.
well, not just them, right? So not just them, but myself and you as well, right? So, What I've observed, at least anecdotally, is that, you know, what lockdown has basically done is it's helped a lot of us just understand the gravity of the situation and the need to start exercising the necessary precautions. Before this, even once corona had been reported, it was just one of those things. Oh, well, we'll see. You know, I still went to the shop, certainly without masks and all of those things. So the entire system has to, you know, come to terms with what is happening and realize that you can't go back. Even if we go to level one tomorrow, you can't go back to things being normal. And I think we now get that. Yeah. And now we get that, right? We've slowed the system down long enough. People have seen, the effects and so on. And I think we now get it. Now we can start being released into the wild again, hoping that enough of us are going to use the necessary precautions. You know, one of my colleagues was saying, Gareth, yesterday that, you know, when the HIV AIDS thing really, really started to take hold, she worked in a professional environment, and And there were a lot of very smart people. And she was just saying to us, look, there's a very lot of smart people who died with their smartness because they were just, you know, it was similar. The news was just emerging. We were all trying to grapple with it. We were all coming to understand with it. And without that degree, you know, without that sense of, guys, this is really serious, a lot of people continued with life as usual, and they're now dead. And I think that the nature of leading an entire government with multiple stakeholders is that it's not just about you trying to grapple with the issues. It's how do you get your citizens to also grapple with this issue? And once we all have the same mind about what the risks are, then it begins to change our behavior. Otherwise...
But in that respect, I think they've gotten it extremely wrong, though, Rory.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that they have failed and consistently failed at, for me, is persuading the public. So it's engaging they've had an extremely authoritarian, top-down, we were just talking about the fascist nature of our policing and law enforcement, it hasn't been a bit of a hearts and minds. I think that's where you get far more of a take-up of an idea, is if you engage people and you have a conversation with people so that they can understand and allow them to go through the stages of it. All of these things, they come in stages, right? You start with the disbelief until the point where you eventually kind of come to accept it. But you've got to sell the idea to people. This is not going to be something that you're going to enforce. You're not going to press it down.
And I'm so glad that you brought up HIV, because there, people continued with life because the president fucked up really badly there too, as you recall.
Absolutely,
And that was his biggest failure, and it's going to, we mentioned Thabo Mbeki at the beginning of this, but honestly, one of the reasons that people didn't change their behavior, and remember, Rory, we're not dealing with all over the world. There are populations who just don't care. Even when they're told that you are too fat, you don't exercise enough, you eat food that is bad for you, you've got high cholesterol, people don't care. They just carry on. They drink too much. They smoke. I don't know that you're ever going to be able to convince people that eating healthily, not drinking, doing exercise, even if it's between 6 and 9 in the morning, is the way to go.
Not smoking.
No, and with all the best intentions in the world, you know, you thank God that the USA came in on the part of HIV and established means for us to pass around antiretrovirals to the majority of the population, or we would have had far more deaths from HIV, correct?
Absolutely. But guys, for me, it just comes down to the fact that in an emerging crisis where you don't have all of the information, the biggest determinant of how you behave is the consequence to being wrong. Ultimately, we might not say that the message has not passed on, but I certainly, just by observation, you see the number of people wearing masks and so on has gone up. Yes, I'm not saying that it's been perfect or near perfect at all. But has the message landed that there is something that's of serious concern within the public? I think there certainly is. And I think you see it particularly where there's a lot at stake for people, right? So, for instance, the going back to schools and how there's quite a lot of resistance about sending kids back to school. Now, that is not government. That is the people who are saying, I'm not sending my child back there, because while I see your statistics, issue is that I'm not risking with my child. I don't want my child to be the rounding error.
Yeah, but there is a danger that we go too far to the other side and we actually become fearmongers. And we make this disease out to be far more dangerous and deadly than it is. And it occurs to me that looking at the state of play in places like Italy, Spain, South Korea, which you mentioned earlier, and China, frankly, which has reopened for all intents and purposes in every single way, that this disease is not the impending peril of mankind that it was painted to be for us at the very beginning of the story. And it looks like governments all over the world have overreacted according to what statistical evidence we can gather now. And now they're doubling down, Rory, because they're embarrassed that they've fucked up. They've basically sold their economies down the river. They've plunged people into poverty and starvation in many places, certainly unemployment in others. And it's their disaster. They locked down the economy, not the disease. and their locking down of the economy may have far-ranging consequences that may be much more deadly than this. So, of course, they're gonna double down on the side of this thing is still dangerous and it's still going to kill millions of us. At what point, and this is where I'd like both of you to just let's try to predict what kind of an outcome there might be, because that's part of being able to scenario plan. What numbers would make, and this is a horrible question to ask, but it's also something very realistic, because public policy is always a trade-off, right? It's a trade-off between do we sacrifice this or that? Something loses, yeah. Something wins somewhere.
Yeah.
At what point do we look back and go, a million people died, and if it's a million, or 100,000 people, or 10,000 people, the lockdown was a worthwhile measure brought into place by a government who genuinely cared about people and wanted to save lives, or the government overreacted and they doubled down and they couldn't find a way out, and they've gone with this narrative, even though the number of deaths has been minimal. It's been the same as the number of people who die of TB every month in South Africa. Where is that? Because that's really what we've got to look at.
So I think that there's a third path. I think there's a third way of looking at it. And I think that the third way of looking at it is that in some respects, what the government has done is they have given themselves a way out of an incredibly terrible situation. What COVID was, is it has been a blessing for Cyril.
Mm-hmm.
COVID has been a blessing for Cyril.
Politically.
Because the reality of it is that our economy was in bad shape.
Yep.
And there were no ideas as to how to get the economy out of the rut that it is in. And there are still no ideas. But this distraction of COVID, there's actually a survival problem that we should be dealing with. What it's done is it's taken, for a lot of people, their eye off the ball of the fact that our economy wasn't working. So even as we're saying, open up the economy, what the reality is, our economy, even if we open it up right now, is sitting at 0.00000001%.
I think it's moving backwards, actually, at the moment, to a fairly severe degree.
But we are in an economy of services and retail. We don't manufacture anything,
but
right?
Me,
and when we have no money to spend, which is where we were, the government had no money to spend,
right.
And private sector is cash conserving.
Well, now we've gone and we've gone and borrowed even more. Listen, I think you're absolutely right. You're saying essentially, and you can correct me if I don't paraphrase you properly here, but this has given Cyril an excuse.
Absolutely.
So,
we should not
confuse an excuse, a convenient political excuse, with doing the right thing, which they're trying to show their actions being equated to. Doing the right thing in this case may not be the same as making an excuse for themselves.
Yeah, but guys, again, remember that this guy has to juggle multiple variables, right? So definitely has given him an excuse. But at the same time, I think you need to consider, the population that he leads. I suspect that on a balance of probabilities, South Africans are a lot more sensitive to death than they are to the economic, and I'm talking about the majority of the people that vote for him.
I agree.
They're a lot more sensitive to death than they are to what happens in the economy. Yes, they will, they will lose jobs, they will go hungry, and so on. But I think the argument for most people, or the contention for most people, is that, well, most of us are already unemployed, and so we don't have really a stake in this economy. But what we do have is we've got life, and you see this. You see this in, if you look at it anthropologically, you see this in people.
Rory.
So let me just. So when you see this in how people will live in utter poverty, and then when they go out, when they die, they spend a lot of money. We value death in this country. And so as a guy who's trying to get reelected and so on, those things, they play on your mind. Donald Trump has been.
What if we end up with extra death and extra economic depravity? Let's say we end up with a situation where this thing does peak in September and we do lose millions of people. And
yeah.
and we've lost the ability for those people to go out and earn a living because there just are no jobs and there is no money in the economy and they are desperate and starving and government have run out of money to supply them with food parcels. Then what happens?
I don't dispute that. I'm simply saying that for a guy like Cyril, he's basically he's placing his bets on the possibility that that is a far-off concern. Right now, I've got an immediate concern that I have to deal with. I don't think it's an either-or between the economy and the people, actually. It's just a matter of saying, well, you know, what's the point? Where's the trade-off point?
You know, let's just look at another fact that because people, you talk about how the economy is, it's about economy or death for some people. It really isn't because the biggest killer of children in this country is diarrheal disease, right? Mm-hmm. Biggest reason that we have child mortality in South Africa is because people are in poverty. So the two are inextricably linked. The one is not some made-up imaginary construction and the other one a real-life situation where you're burying a body. They're both very much interlinked.
For me and you, except that the one isn't linked directly to government's failure. You know, when a baby in an impoverished community dies, the conversation that happens isn't fundamentally a conversation that circulates around the failings of government. You and I are able to look at it as that.
Yeah.
But when something like this happens, this has positioned itself as an issue of government that reflects on government's effectiveness or not. So I think that's the thing we have to bear in mind.
Rory-san. Well, look at that. Sure. Rory Sang. The incisive nature of that, that is one of the things that I've been trying to grapple with.
Mm.
And I saw David Bullard tweeting about why it's so difficult to have this argument rationally around the lockdown.
Mm.
And the fact that here we have got something, and I think that the Thabo Mbeki conversation that is positioned squarely in the face of if government fails us on this.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the little things, I mean, that we're watching government mobilize and deliver on things that we're wondering.
Where were these
water tanks?
Yeah.
To give water to people in, you know what I'm saying?
I think this means that
they had no political will to do it before.
Yeah,
that there was
absolutely
nothing making them do it. And now, because it's such an emotional thing, the idea of people dying because government did not do X.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Well, you've exploded my mind. It's a cold and callous thing to also say that the death of kids doesn't necessarily have a political cost, but the death of people from COVID does. That's a frightening thing.
That's the hard reality, Gareth. That's exactly it. No better way of putting it. And I think to the extent that we all continue to argue on the extremes as opposed to arguing at the point of the complex trade-offs, that's when we fail to move forward. The issue, we're not stuck because anyone disagrees that the economy is important or that lives are important. We're stuck because no one knows how to do the complex trade-off between the two.
Well, Rory, this is one of the reasons I've missed talking to you, because you certainly get me thinking, and I appreciate very much the amount of work that you've been doing behind the scenes to bring us to an awareness of this stuff. And I hope that we get to chat to you again soon. Let's also hope that
we don't
have anything near the number of deaths that are predicted by all these models.
Certainly.
Which is the thing that's astounding. When I look at the numbers coming out of the US, I'm absolutely astounded at how quickly these numbers have ballooned out of control. And in particular areas, too. I was reading an article over the weekend in the New York Times about a mortuary in Brooklyn that has actually been shut down now because they were keeping bodies in the fridge because they just couldn't get them buried quickly enough. And I was just like, this is a shit show.
And then we hear about all those field hospitals that are empty. You know, we hear about all these beds that have been prepared for all these patients that never arrived.
And the ventilators wrangled away from France.
And here, and everybody else. So let's keep paying attention to all sides of this argument, Rory. It's always good to see you.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Rory.
And Pumelele, that brings us to the end, because thank you, Rory. It's time for Blind History, featuring a woman of some incredible repute and prowess, because really in the 20th century, especially at the beginning of it, there were not a lot of people, there were not a lot of women who had the kind of influence over society that Eva Perón did, particularly in South America. And her influence continues to be felt today. She was born into poverty. She was ordinary, but man, did she have ambition. And she climbed that ladder. She did whatever it took to get ahead. And she ended up becoming the most influential woman in South America for a long time. Her body.
Spoiler alert.
Yes.
I do not chime in this episode and sing Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
Please do not.
Oh, how sad.
Please do not.
But, spoiler.
But interestingly enough, the story of what happened to her body after her death is almost as interesting as the story of what happened during her life. So you can hear all about that in our latest episode of Blind History, which, of course, is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. They are back in action. So if you need to, if you've been staying in your house over the last few months and thinking, my God, I need to do something with these windows, which many of us have. These are the guys to contact. We don't market the hell out of what they do, but they'd make incredible products. And you can find out from Taylor Blinds and Shutters how they can make your house or your office or whatever space you've been inhabiting in the last little while for lockdown that much more sophisticated. They can make light work for you in ways that it hasn't up to now. And you know what? You'll even look better in those Zoom meetings if you just have decent window dressing. It makes all the difference in the world. Blinds, shutters, do it properly, and you won't ever look back. It'll be an investment.
It will also stop you from seeing what your neighbors are doing and having to report them to the police.
Thank you. So Karens especially need to invest in good blinds and shutters so that they can combat their neighbors reporting on each other. All right? Good move. All right. Thank you very much, Pumi.
Bye, guys. Sia.
All right. And coming up, Eva Perón, Blind History, Season 3, Episode 9. Also on the way after 8 o'clock, Reg Lascaris. I've been talking about this for the last 4 days because I found Reg to be absolutely mind-alteringly fascinating when I spoke to him on Friday. He's been doing a lot of research into what people are doing to market, communicate, and advertise during this time. You do not want to miss this. It's 8 o'clock this morning, Reg Lascaris, who, of course, is the co-founder of TBWA, Hunt Lascaris, currently the advertising agency's president for Africa and the Middle East. He's also an author, and you can hear his thoughts on what's going on during COVID next. At the end of the famous musical, there's a less well-known verse of Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, sung after the death of Eva Perón. She sings, "Don't cry for me, Argentina, for I am ordinary, unimportant, and undeserving of such attention, unless we all are. Ride on my train, O my people, and when it's your turn to die, you'll remember. They fired those cannons, sang lamentations, not just for Eva, for everybody. Maybe, just maybe, the greatest female figure in South American history was onto something. Or perhaps she was just a movie star on a political stage." Welcome to another episode of Blind History, and today we focus on Maria Eva Duarte. A lot of people have said that we don't feature enough women in history, and so we decided we'd look at one in the 20th century who made an enormous impact on her country. She's better known as Eva Perón, Evita, the wife of Argentine President Juan Perón and the First Lady of Argentina from 1946 until her death in 1952. She was born in poverty in a rural village in Los Taldos, which is in the Pampas, as the youngest of five kids. In 1934, at the age of 15, she moved to Buenos Aires to pursue a career as a stage, radio, and film actress. Now, she met there a man called Colonel Juan Perón in 1944, and she decided to immediately become his mistress. They were married the following year,
And during 6 years of their marriage, she became so powerful within the pro-Peronist trade unions and in the Eva Peron Foundation, which she later established, that she pretty much was ready to run for vice president. The only problem was, during that time, she'd also developed cervical cancer, and she was very, very ill. So there are all kinds of stories about what happened to her body after Eva had died, but there was an elaborate funeral, which we'll talk about in a minute, and she became an icon in international popular culture. She was most famously the subject of the musical Evita by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Cristina Alvarez Rodriguez, the first woman elected president of Argentina, claims that Evita never left the collective consciousness of the country. She claims that women of her generation owe a debt to Eva for her example of passion and combativeness. With me for this episode, as always, my co-host and the MD of Taylor Blinds and Shutters, no less than Anthony Medera. How are you, Ant?
Very well, and you, Gareth?
Yeah, good, man. What do you make of Eva Perón in the scale of how history's treated her and the kind of contribution she made to the world?
Well, as a British Foreign Office internal memo said in 1950, dangerous but very remarkable woman. I think that's how I would describe her.
Perfect. So, okay, what do we know about the way she was raised in her early childhood and the beginning of her life? Do you know some things there?
Yeah, so she was obviously brought up in poverty, but her dad was a very well-to-do cattle farmer. And there's so many different rural settlements and small towns in Argentina, and this is just one of many. But unfortunately for Eva and her four other siblings, they were illegitimate. And the father went back to his first wife, or his wife, because their mother was never married to this gentleman. So she was brought up illegitimate, and she tried to hide this fact most of her life. But I think that that played a big part in her psyche. And to such an extent that they weren't allowed to go to their dad's funeral when he passed away. Wow. They were allowed to just give their rites and say goodbye, but they weren't allowed to go to the funeral. So that shaped her. But she was a very, very strong woman and very, very ambitious, I think. And she really knew what she wanted. And if you can just think about it, the age of 15, if you compare ourselves at the age of 15, she decided to go on her own to Buenos Aires, which is a massive city compared to this little town or development in the rural area, to go and try her luck and see if she can find success there. So very, very impressive and very brave.
Well, in her autobiography, she actually explained that all the people from her town who had been to big cities described them as marvelous places where nothing was given but wealth. And so when she got there, it was all dazzle and dream, and she obviously did whatever she had to do, and you can read between the lines what that was. But she made friends with the local artistic community. She had an affair with a guy called Magaldi, who seems to have helped her climb to the top. And her sisters maintain that she traveled to Buenos Aires with their mother, but others say that she went with a man and then ended up being his mistress. But that wasn't a problem for her. She would do whatever she needed to do to get ahead. In modern terms, we would call her a hustler, right?
Yeah, 100% correct. But she was brilliant. And the big thing was she wasn't particularly talented, but she was extremely persistent. And she was probably one of the highest paid women in media at the age of 24. So it just shows whatever she did and however she hustled, she did a very, very good job.
Well, by 1936, she was touring nationally with a theater company. She'd worked as a model. She was cast in a few B-grade movie melodramas. And she had a little bit of economic stability because she had a daily role in one of the radio dramas. So among other things, she had played a couple of roles by then, and she seemed ready to take the next step. She, in 1942, was able to move into her apartment in the exclusive neighborhood of Recoleta. And the next year, she began her career in politics as one of the founders of the Argentine Radio Syndicate.
Yeah, and I think this is at the time, or very close to the time, she actually met Juan Perón at a fundraising gala. And I think that was where the big stage came for Eva.
Yeah, she says she fell in love with him immediately. I think it was probably the other way around. I mean, she was an attractive woman. By today's standards, maybe not, because in the 1940s, there was a certain look which was kind of epitomized by the Marlene Dietrichs and the rest of them. And she bleached her hair blonde. Her natural color was actually dark. But she called that day that she met Juan her marvelous day. And they apparently were at that gala until 2 in the morning, dancing and drinking and spending huge amounts of time with each other. And then after that, they basically became an item. She moved in with him, became his mistress, and the rest is kind of history, but that's the history we're interested in exploring.
Yeah, I think that what he said, though, just on the other side of the coin, he said that Eva was pale, but when she spoke, her face seemed to catch fire. So I think he was very, very taken by her.
Yeah, I mean, she must have been an impressive person because, first of all, she had that desperation and that need to succeed that poor people often do when they see themselves given an opportunity to rise. But she also had acting, she had beauty, she had, you know, drama and talent, and she had this flair for that Argentine sort of that melodramatic stuff that we see in those telenovelas. I think that's kind of the person that she must have been. And he couldn't resist. They announced that she would marry him, and they did get married eventually. And she also started a union of people in broadcasting, and she was getting very political. So it suited her to be married to a guy who was also making some big moves in the government.
She devoted a huge amount of time meeting with the poor Argentinians, visiting hospitals and orphanages, and she founded then, I think at that time, the Female Peronist Party, which is a political party just comprised of female voters. And I think what was important was that women didn't get the vote at the time, just prior to this. And I think she managed then to, be it her fundamentally doing it or other reasons, but the women did get the vote during that time as well.
Well, also it suited Juan Perón, and it suited a lot of other people who were standing for election at that time to have women vote because she was so popular that she would have given them the votes. And Juan Perón actually was locked up for a little while. He was arrested and he was put in jail by a number of other officers and eventually released, mostly under pressure from, you know, the public that Eva had rallied. And she worked with a number of non-government organizations, but also some very political parties. And she had support from the descamisados, who were the workers and the poor, as you've already indicated. And they said at that stage that her popularity was already eclipsing that of the sitting president. And she managed to get 350,000 people gathered in front of what was called the Casa Rosada, which is Argentina's government house, to demand Juan Perón's release. And their wish was granted. So a very powerful statement there of just how much clout she had.
But she also, once again, and like so many of the people we've talked about in history, very, very charismatic, but also very clever. And she knew exactly what she wanted to do. Whenever in public with Juan, she would paint him as a saint and she would always be on at his side. But behind the scenes, she was powerful. She knew how to present Juan. She basically ruled his life. She actually ultimately was in control of the fortunes of Argentina behind the scenes.
Well, it's no doubt that due to her, he won the 1946 presidential election. They won by a landslide. She campaigned heavily for him, even while he was in jail. And using her weekly radio show, she used to deliver speeches with lots of populism in it, stuff that today would never be allowed on the radio. And then once he became president, she decided it was about her. And she went on this European tour, which was very controversial.
Yeah, the Rainbow Tour. I think that's what they termed it. She traveled to Spain, Italy, France, I think Switzerland, and then she was obviously destined to go to England as well. And Francisco Franco, the famous General Franco, received her with open arms. And interestingly enough, when she went to Italy to meet Pope Pius XII, she really believed she'd get something special from him for all the hard work she'd done in the past. And that's where you get a little bit of her fame whoring, as some people would term. And he basically just gave her a rosary, so her nose was a bit out of joint. And yes, she went to Paris, but then she wanted to stay at Buckingham Palace, and she wasn't allowed to. So she just said she was very, very tired, and she never, ever actually went to England.
Yeah, she indicated that she wanted to go to England. The king, George VI, actually said, look, whether or not it's a state visit, I'm not going to have her stay at Buckingham Palace. And that kind of put her nose out of joint, and she decided, fine, I'll just pretend I'm exhausted. But apparently in Switzerland, they threw stones at the car that she was in and cracked the windshield. And they also threw tomatoes. they threw tomatoes at the guy who was driving with her, and some of it splashed on her. And she decided after that, hell no, I'm going back to Argentina.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of, obviously, the fascism that's related to the way that they're politicking, Nazi sympathetic you know, she had her supporters, but also she definitely had her detractors. And I think, you know, when you look at history and what happened to many of those vicious Nazi criminals, we hear that some of them popped up in Argentina. And it's at the time that Juan Perón was in power, and he certainly facilitated the escape of what we know of Joseph Mengele.
War criminals, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, Joseph Mengele was frightening. He was the concentration camp doctor who conducted those hideous experiments on inmates. That's just scary. And then Adolf Eichmann was one of the chief executors of Hitler's Final Solution. And then Klaus Barbie, the most notorious of them all, and he was a murderous Gestapo chief. And so those are the ones that are known. So I can definitely see where the Perón administration would come under fire as well.
Yeah, and she tried to say that it wasn't a political tour and that it was a goodwill tour, and she was trying to get investment into Argentina, and she promised the French lots of wheat and all kinds of other things. But essentially, her husband was so political that by definition, she was too. And I don't think she entirely hated that. But she didn't just go and visit and do all these public engagements. She also had very complicated hairstyles. She had this very expensive shopping list while she was there too. She went into all the Paris couturiers and bought fashion from Christian Dior, jewels from Cartier, and she started to really look like a bit of a princess. And this impacted badly on her back home. So after that, once she'd returned back home, she read the tea leaves and decided, uh-oh, better dress a little more conservatively. And she started looking more like a businesswoman. And even though she dressed down, those were still made by Dior and other Paris couture houses. So she wanted to look nice, but she didn't want to blow the blow the water out of the picture.
Yeah, that's probably why the French liked her so much. It wasn't wasn't a political thing. I think she just spent a lot of money in Paris.
So apparently she was quite controversial when it came to money, not just fashion. And there was the Eva Perón Foundation, which began with only 10,000 pesos that she gave kindly out of her own private money. But it grew to be quite a monster.
She worked very, very long hours giving money, as you mentioned, and medicine to the poor, touching and kissing the sick. But, you know, Princess Diana springs to mind a little bit here. And then she emphasizing with the plight of, as you'd mentioned earlier in the podcast, descamisados, which is the poor workers, and it literally means the shirtless ones. Funding of her foundation came from unions, taxes, and levies, and businesses that were pressured or forced to contribute money. So that's where we got a split between the poor working class that supported, definitely wholeheartedly supported Eva and Juan, but big business and the middle class and upper class didn't. You know, there was no support whatsoever, and the taxes were very heavy to support the poor.
Yeah, I mean, as I said just now, she started with 10,000 meager pesos from her own money, but then it eventually ended up being an enormous foundation that had assets in excess of 3 billion pesos. And as you said, they even used to scalp the lottery. They'd force businesses to give money, but they did do a lot of good. They helped people with shoes, sewing machines, cooking pots. They built homes, hospitals, all kinds of other good things. She even built a place called Evita City, which still exists today. And she worked. This woman worked. She worked 20 to 22 hours a day for the foundation, often ignoring her husband's request that she cut back. The more she worked, the more she adopted this attitude of outrage towards the existence of poverty, saying that it's unacceptable that people live this way. And she became almost like a Mother Teresa. And you mentioned Princess Diana. It's interesting. She kind of occupied the same space as being this outwardly saintly woman, who obviously had, you know, massive motivation for doing what she did, but nonetheless was also gathering a nice little war chest of her own. What she didn't realize at the time, obviously, is that she was very, very ill. And I think all of this hard work, you know, she was traveling the whole country, she was meeting all these sick people all the time, and it exhausted her to the point where she didn't realize that she had cancer.
Yeah, which was, I think, very, very sad, because she passed away at the age of just 33, which is very, very young.
Yeah, and before that, as indicated in the introduction, she did run for vice president for a little while and then realized after her illness was starting to become a major problem that she actually couldn't do it anymore. And they say that she was probably given a prefrontal lobotomy. This is not the first time we've encountered one of those in blind history. in the last months of her life to relieve the pain, agitation, and anxiety that she suffered in the final months of her illness. But she was called spiritual leader of the nation. She was given the most incredible and elaborate funeral in Argentinian history. I mean, nearly 3 million people attended her funeral in the streets of Buenos Aires. The flowers were just, it would make Princess Diana look like a picnic. And Eva Perón, ever since, has been regarded as a saint by many Argentines. Perón, obviously himself, his career started to hit the skids after she died. They embalmed her, funnily enough, and they put her into a tomb in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. And then the biggest mystery is that the body disappeared.
But I think, Gareth, that was definitely driven because there was a military coup, which is ironic because he came in not to power, but he came in behind a military coup, you know, in the early 40s. So there was a military coup that overthrew Juan and he fled to Spain. And I think that it was definitely driven towards the incumbents getting rid of any sign of the power that she had. So they felt that if her body was still on display somewhere in Argentina, it would create havoc, and they really wanted to have maximum control. So they kidnapped her body and apparently buried it somewhere in Milan. And it was only much later it was found out. But this is where it gets really, really weird. The corpse stayed in Milan until 1971, where it was disinterred and given to Juan Perón, who was in Madrid. And the body was damaged. And his third wife, Isabel, who actually became president when he died, brushed her hair, cleansed her body, and put her on display in their dining room.
Which, oh, my God.
Which I find offsides a bit, but each their own, I suppose.
Good heavens. Well, she was eventually exhumed and, as you say, flown to Spain. She was put on display in the dining room, but they eventually sent her back to Argentina and put her in a crypt in the Duarte family tomb in the Recoleta Cemetery, which is still a place people visit. It's all under lock and key now, and they've pretty much made it as secure as possible. They've got a marble floor with a trap door that leads to a compartment containing two coffins. Under that compartment is a second trap door and a second compartment. And they say that this tomb is so secure it could withstand a nuclear attack.
It's incredible, but she definitely had a massive influence. And if you look at Peronism throughout modern history, post Eva's passing away, I mean, the president today is a Peronist. And there's been different uptakes of what it really means and the application of it. But overall, it's still very much what they very much believed in, Juan and Eva.
Well, she's on the 100 peso note issued in 2012 and onwards. And the titles have been everything, as I said, from spiritual leader of the nation to Her Excellency, First Lady of the Nation. I mean, you couldn't wish to be more. In a country like Argentina, she's regarded so highly, even so many years after her death. But there we go. Eva Perón, definitely not a boring woman and definitely not a weak woman and definitely not someone who, if she had lived longer, wouldn't have made an even bigger impact on the history books. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pope Francis, the current pope, is a Peronist to the bitter end. He was a huge admirer in his youth of the dictator Juan Perón. And for over 5 years, all of Francis's most prominent lessons have been cautionary and political. But what came out of all of this was that he was supporting definitely the attempts to bridge the class divide. So he was 100% behind them, which is quite interesting to note that there was a link between our current pope and Eva and Juan Perón.
Lately, I've been thinking, I want you to be happier. CliffCentral.com.